Hello, everyone. My name is Joshua Gilliland, one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. We are here to discuss She-Hulk Episode 5 and the labyrinth of copyright and trademark issues that are in this episode. This is how lawyers think. We put things in terms of cases. The lineup tonight, just going through the order in Zoom, Mark Zaid, Gregory Pang, Mark Hershon, Jennifer Berry, and Jordan Hubert. All right. Are we all ready to go?
Ready to rumble.
Let's go.
All right. The game's afoot. So this is another weird trial episode that, for the sake of waiting. All right, so this is one of those episodes where civil litigators go, why? For a dinner last night with two IP attorneys, it was lively discussed with the issues of why and what would work and what would not work. So, Mark Z, you raised the issue of why is Titania doing a Tammy Faye impression? Thoughts on this?
Yeah, I was... In today's day and age, I was concerned if I should even write that down on something like this. I have a feeling most people probably don't even remember who Tammy Faye was as a New Yorker. She was a very big personality as well. But I guess, from the religious standpoint, more so big personality. But she's passed away, and she was the wife of, I'm blanking on what her husband's first name was, Baker. Tammy Faye.
I have sinned against you. Yes. So
right. And yeah, she
Baker.
Just
Jim, according to
Jim Baker. Yeah. Thank you. She was there. I was at beginning. I was thinking of Leona Helmsley as a New Yorker. Tammy Faye Baker is not a New Yorker. I forget where she was from. But she was very well known for wearing incredible amount of eyeshadow and eye makeup and everything. And to me, that's just what. It's not a legal issue, but that's what Titania was reminding me of. As soon as I saw that, I guess I date myself back to the 80s or 90s in remembering Tammy Faye Baker, God rest her soul. But that,
well, you know, there was a movie or a show, I think, in the last year or so. So I think there was a Tammy Faye resurgence starring Jessica Chastain.
I might not have been the only one.
I mean, I'm also old, so I also got the reference, but...
Or Leona Helmsley would also fit in that category of the same type of person from that type of makeup. I don't know anything about this actress who plays this character. And I was doing a little checking up on the character to see where they came from, and amazed to learn actually came from Secret Wars number 3, which was back in my time in the mid 80s, like 85, 86. I don't remember. Honestly, I have to go back and look at my issues. I don't remember what bit role she played in Secret Wars issue 3, but she's been around for 35, 36 years.
Yeah, and if I remember right, was associated with the Absorbing Man, who was killed off in the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. series, which I don't know if that's still canon or not, but there's that element. So with having the Wrecking Crew, that, you know, it kind of ties together. But
and the actress, Jameela Jamil, was in The Good Place. Very much a different character than she played on there. Almost unrecognizable in the Titania role.
Oh, my. Oh, my, that's right.
Yeah, she played Tahani Al-Jamil in The Good Place.
Great show,
main
place.
Characters.
A Good Place, yeah.
She reminded me, the character in all the makeup and stuff reminded me of one of those QVC people. You know, one of those barkers on there selling all that crap that they try to get people to buy.
Yes. And speaking of buying, that's where all of the legal issues start coming in, because there is, she does a rush to market with a product line with the name She-Hulk in it. And this is after Jennifer Walters has appeared as the She-Hulk. Now, Greg and Mark with an H are here because they can help with some of the IP issues. So Greg, help us understand some of the trademark issues that are coming into play, and then we'll pivot to Mark.
Sure thing, Josh. Just a little bit of a caveat to start off. I am a Canadian trademark lawyer. And so although I believe from what I know of U.S. trademark law, the concepts are similar, and perhaps in some cases analogous, if not similar. So I'll be speaking from the point of view of a Canadian trademark lawyer. So please, if my learned friends can do so, correct me if I speak some Canadianisms in my trademark overview here that are not the same in U.S. trademark law. So one thing that I found very interesting, and it's kind of as a trademark lawyer, it used to bug me when on TV, and you know that the layperson, that's fine because that's just the way they do it. But on TV, they use the term trademarking. I'm putting it in air quotes, trademarking as a verb, which is they use it synonymously usually with filing to register a trademark. So I think we have to distinguish here what is trademarking, or like at least define what is trademarking. There's could be two things. There's one is using a name, a slogan, a logo, et cetera, as a trademark versus applying to register a trademark within the United States. That would be the USPTO, the United States Patent and Trademark Office, and Canada, the Canadian Intellectual Property Office. So here, what it appears to be is that Titania has filed to register a trademark. And I listened to the previous episode of The Legal Geeks about the last episode of She-Hulk. And whoever explained this was correct, saying that filing to register a trademark is not something that you can just get the next day. It can take a while. I think in my experience with sending filings to my U.S. associates, it would be something 8 to 12 months for something that's relatively problem-free. Just as a side note, in Canada, we are not as efficient as you Americans, maybe because we're a little bit socialist or something like that here, but it could take right now our backlog because of COVID, because of a bunch of different excuses. It's like 2 years from filing to full registration of a trademark where there are no substantive objections and where there's no opposition. 2 years is what it looks like looking right now. Anyway, so it leads to the comment, Jen's brother, what was his brother's or her brother's name? Ched, was that right?
Yes. Her Ched. Cousin. I think is her brother
cousin.
Or cousin?
Cousin. I think
she's cousin. Ched.
Okay. Cousin Ched, right? So he stated, trying to give Jen some legal advice as a very wise Best Buy store manager, that it's Jen, it's the first to trademark. Didn't you know that, Jen, or something to that effect?
Whoever gets there first gets it.
That's, yes, that's what he said. So if he's saying that whoever is the first to use in commerce, the general rule is yes, but it's not the first to register. And going back to the distinction between using a trademark in commerce in the United States law language versus registration, your rights actually accrue when you use something as a trademark, not to register. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But so he might be right in some context, but maybe not right in others. So that's kind of the little bit long and short of, you know, trademark rights in itself. And Josh, you want me to go on about like just talking about whether Jen would need to trademark her name to protect it?
Yes, because that's, okay. Yes.
Okay.
Please.
So you know, flowing from that, from Chad saying, yeah, you should have trademarked it. So the question is, does Jen need to trademark her name to protect it? And the short answer is no. Can she? Yes. And our learned panelist, I'm not sure if he's on this time, said last time, your last episode, I think he explained very well on circumstances where you can register your name to protect it and so on, but we won't really get too much into that. So she can, but in this case, she doesn't need to. And that's where we'll go on later to about the right of publicity, right? She could defend it there or in some other fashion. So now going to something else that is interesting is that it was stated that Jen was being sued by Titania for trademark infringement. So I think it's the same in the US, please correct me if I'm wrong, that you can't sue for infringement unless you have a registration. And we already, you know, in the real world, unless the MCU, they have super powered examining attorneys at the USPTO, you can't push forward an application from filing to registration unless there's a massive time compression here that she would be able to, Titania would be able to get it registered. So unless she got it registered, actually registered with the USPTO, then she could not sue for trademark infringement. In Canada, that doesn't mean that, you know, it, without an infringement that you can't protect your trademark. In Canada, we can sue for passing off, either statutory or common law passing off, the tort of passing off. I think in the US, yeah, the equivalent or the rough equivalent is there's a tort of unfair competition, or one of the torts of unfair competition, where you have to establish good, for passing off, you establish goodwill or reputation, you have to prove misrepresentation, and then you have to prove damages or likelihood of damages. So that aside, is she suing for infringement? Okay, let's say yes, that the MCU USPTO is much better than our real life one. So she'd have to prove a number like that she actually, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole right now, because it just seems so crazy and ludicrous that she'd be able to do that. So, but the other thing is that when she filed for it, and I've seen this in the USPTO, where someone tries to file for a trademark that is using someone else's famous name, relatively famous name. And in particular, I do have an example. I'm not going to actually pull it up, but I don't like speaking the name, but it was a filing for something Trump, right? Something, I forget exactly what the trademark filing was.
You're fired.
maybe something like that, right?
At least that was a big one. I think I talked about that in the last episode.
Right.
That was a big Trump trademark dispute, because it was going to put out of business a bakery somewhere Midwest, I think. That's what they were called. You're fired, because they were baking in a kiln or whatever bakery oven they were using or something.
And I believe
maybe it was a pottery place. I forget.
Right.
Pottery or bakery, something like that.
And I believe the examiner objection here, like it kind of analogous to that, is that there was a Trump trademark filing by someone who was not an affiliate company or Donald Trump himself. And the examining attorney actually cited an objection that, no, you are trying, this is actually a famous person, you can't use this trademark because it's already, you know, it is the name of a famous person or something to that effect, right? I haven't seen any kind of similar objection here in Canada, but I've seen that in the United States. So I imagine in real life that if this were to happen in real life, then the USPTO examining attorney would have objected to her registration.
Well, there was also, I mean, you when you file now. My name is Mark Hirschman, by the way, and I'm not an attorney, but I have been in the world of branding and trademarks for the last 30 years, and have developed a number of famous marks, brands, trademarks, whatnot, and have done extensive searching in the USPTO and things like that. So I know a little bit about a lot of things. And one of the things is when you file your trademark at the USPTO, it gets published for opposition. So there is a time period where somebody can step forward, and apparently by the time frame in the show, there was no period where there was a chance for opposition. There was also an interesting element I was thinking about was, in reality, She-Hulk is actually sort of a sub-brand to Hulk. And I don't know if Bruce Banner ever filed for Hulk as a trademark registration, but has been using it for upwards of a number of years. And
Tony Stark probably did.
Perhaps, but the protections would be there whether it was registered or not. And so,
especially like, what about Hulk Hogan?
Well, that might be an infringement, actually, right? On the Incredible Hulk. I don't know. But I don't know if Hulk Hogan exists in the MCU. That would be another element to have to be taking into consideration. So I think She-Hulk had a number of viable arguments against Titania's attempt to get the She-Hulk name registered. Although in terms of being in trade, Jennifer has sold nothing under the She-Hulk name. So in terms of, well, was it actually a name in trade, or is she famously She-Hulk? And how do you establish that? I think by the specimens that they producing the show, I don't know if that's really famous enough. It's not really public in terms of a dating app that your name is out there.
What about her law firm that hired her specifically to use the publicity of having She-Hulk to sell their law firm and to retain clients?
Oh, I think that's interesting. It would depend, I suppose, if it's in a contract that we are hiring She-Hulk to represent clients, then that would certainly establish a date in which the name was being used professionally, which would probably be the defining point.
Just to add a couple things. So first, in Endgame, we see the Hulk sign autographs and telling people Hulk out. So maybe that's a catchphrase that's been used for at least 5 years with him signing autographs. Maybe there's something there. Yeah. And secondly, to give Mark Hirschhorn a proper introduction, lawyers bring in expert witnesses all the time. Mark is falling into that category right now to help us understand the IP issues. Mark is a co-creator and host of the Succotash podcast. I know him more from the comedy world. He's known my brother for 20 years, and I've known him since a San Francisco Sketch Fest a couple years ago.
When you guessed it on Succotash, that's right.
Yes, and getting to hang out with you and Matt Weinhold. So, yes. But he knows my brother Gabe far better. So, but when this dropped, Mark messaged immediately and offered his services to be able to appear. And since I've been on Succotash, here we go. So bringing Mark's expertise in to talk about trademarks. So any other comments, Mark?
I was just thinking about just the fact that trademark in the United States is actually common law, which is why you don't have to have a registered trademark in order to protect your mark. You know, if you were selling pies in a fruit stand in Alabama and somebody came out with Joe's Fruit Pies, and that's what you've been calling them, you could say, I've been selling these things and people have been stopping by for 20 years. And the trademark people look at that, the examiners, they look at that as being, you know, possibly first use. In fact, there's an interesting case with Candy Crush, the video game, right? The phone game. They got a registration on almost any game that could have the word candy in it because they went back and bought a trademark from somebody that had candy. It was like Candy King or something. And it was from 1963, and they somehow were able to, they bought that trademark and were able to prove that that trademark had been in use since 1963. And they've been using it to stomp all over other game makers. So there's all sorts of tricks that can be used when you're trying to jump the competition on some of these things.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with trademark trolls, but apparently that could be one. I'm familiar with the concept of copyright trolls. And
trademark trolls are very much the same.
Yeah,
I've had to deal with some of the copyright trolls, including in the comic book world. It's a pain. They're a pain. You know, I'll add in a few things. Like, I'm not an IP lawyer. I'm a national security lawyer, but I'm dangerous because I can read. So just rattling off some things. And I think this is very different. And Greg or Mark, if you know differently, I think from a historic standpoint, the last few decades and maybe even a shorter period of time have changed how trademark law has been, because you have so many celebrities go into the branding aspect that goes beyond just being on screen, big screen or little screen, where they're doing all sorts of other things, and especially where they have single names. So some celebrities that have succeeded apparently in registering their names as trademarks: Trump, First Lady Melania, Beyonce, Taylor Swift, Rihanna, Victoria Beckham, Justin Bieber, Bruce Springsteen, Katy Perry, and Kylie Jenner. And Kylie Jenner is an interesting one because she had some folks challenge her, including who, if anybody asked me, what Kylie do you know? I would go Kylie Minogue, because that's who I knew from back in the 80s when I lived in London. And she's an Australian singer, but she was on a British soap opera program, and that's when her songs are very popular in the United Kingdom, and apparently they settled out of court, it seems like. But it's very different. Now, the one thing that I noticed in particular with the proceeding, and there's a few things we'll jump back to, is this looked like it was in some sort of county or state court, where it would normally, it would either be federal court or at the USPTO before a hearing examiner. So, you know, She-Hulk, not surprisingly, took a shortcut to just make it look easy. I guess it's probably the same courtroom set that they use for every episode, as well as any other whoever owns this, Disney, Marvel, whoever, wherever this set is, whatever lot, this is what they're using. But it is not where you would normally be litigating.
Yeah, I don't think the trademark examiner's office would make for terrific TV.
No, not even the satellite one in Silicon Valley. So there's there are good folks there. However, not
camera ready.
Because I took issue with, like, why are they in state court? Like, there are state court claims that could be brought in, and we'll talk about those in a moment. It's like, this is federal jurisdiction. Why aren't we in federal court here? And we'll nerd out on the Civ Pro issues. But again, there was some serious problems with, like, we're in state court, and on day one, we're already arguing as opposed to the normal complaint.
Now, was it clarified that it was a federal case? Because it could have been a state registration, trademark registration, as opposed to a federal.
True. And you can make state court trademark claims or trade dress claims as well. So, but it had the TM. So it's like, why are procedurally, it's just weird.
Here's the thing about the TM and the Circle R that people may not know. You can put the TM on something if you have registered for the product, but have not yet received your registration. When you get your registration, that's when you can put the Circle R on there. So anybody can use the TM. It just indicates that you have you're in the process of trying to get your registration.
And maybe that's what Titania did. Like, it was a rush to market of law firms hired Jennifer. We're going to try to hurt her.
Yeah.
Just because.
So the TM is actually factual, which is kind of interesting. They didn't say, well, it's a Circle R, which would mean she got the registration. So that's kind of an interesting wrinkle.
Yeah, and Mark, and I think that's why I said that it's clear to me whether because she was suing for infringement, that indicates registration, but it was not quite established that she had registered. So you are right. Yeah, in that style of clause where they put where she lifted her party, put the little TM. But actually, just on that point, I found it a little bit weird, and maybe my learned American counsel here can enlighten me here. Did a freeze frame of it, and the way that Titania lists herself as the party, I thought was kind of strange. Mary McFerrin as owner of She-Hulk TM by Titania, a company. So usually in an infringement action or passing off action or tort of unfair competition, to state yourself as the owner of the trademark, you're stating as a fact, where that's a fact that you have to prove still, that you have that entitlement because you have the registration or you've been using it, whatever. Really interesting. And Mary McPherson as owner of She-Hulk TM by Titania, comma, a company. Have you seen that before?
No, they're playing with, we will make lawyer words like magic. Like, if you own a corporation, it's the corporation suing. You don't say, and in my personal capacity as the president of the corporation, I'm suing you too. No, I'm like, this is why we have corporate law, why people form a private corporation or LLC or limited liability partnership. It's why we have the entire concept of corporations, is so that's not a personal cause of action. So that way it protects the individual from personal liability. So that's just, someone thought, this would look cool.
And actually, now that the Greg referenced that and I have pulled it up on the screen, I now see that this is a U.S. federal district court cover sheet the Central District of California, which is Los Angeles.
Yes.
And now I didn't see if it had the blue cover sheet because I had a case there recently. And my God, the local rules are ridiculous as to what is required. I remember back in New York State when I first got licensed 30 years ago, we had to do these blue cover sheets. I didn't realize any federal courts did it, but apparently Central District does. So that was a federal court. It looked like it was the same court, I think, that they were in previously every other time. And but that was a federal, that's supposed to be a federal district court.
Yeah. It's funny, the only district court I can actually practice in is the Central District of California, but I've never stepped foot in there. The partner didn't let me go. Mm. So
I've been in a few federal courthouses, but I've never actually appeared in person. In the age of COVID, despite being admitted for now 20 years, you know, in are the federal courts across California, I've only done like two Zoom appearances, and I'm okay with that because there's no commute time, and I absolutely love it because it's judicial economy at its best. No drive, parking, all that complexity. That said, yeah, this did not look like a federal courthouse. And that looked like a county seal on the wall. So that's the other thing was like, why are we in state court? Okay, but it's a federal cover sheet. Yeah, that's like they get close to being right and then they swerve. It is so weird that they do that from, I don't know if they're not listening to their consultants or they're just doing like, I think this looks cooler. So I don't get that. But
I have a theory, Josh.
Yes.
That they in reality don't really like lawyers and they're just trolling us to get us all riled up. Right. So that's my theory.
I was curious if Titania is a registered trademark. We know she's a corporation. And you know, her alter ego, Mary McFerrin. But I never see a circle R or a TM on the Titania name, at least so far in the show that I can think of. So Jennifer could do an end around and attempt to register Titania as a trademark. And then they'd have to do like some sort of exchange in order to back each other off. But in the end, of course, she won the rights to her name. So,
yeah, that's the this is part of the issue that I had with this, and we'll get into it opens the issue of Jennifer's response, because when you work for one of the mega law firms that has an army of attorneys, you don't go to personally confront the other person, you unleash hell. And being in charge of an entire division, okay, we're going to crush you now and let the filings fly. And that would, because there's an army of associates that can go wreak havoc. And that could be one of the things that they do. It's like, fine, we'll do this too. But that was, again, part of my suspension of disbelief. I'm fine with the flying aircraft carrier. I'm fine with the 6'7" green woman who can throw a Toyota. Not leveraging what a law firm can actually do is too much for me.
Maybe we'll see that in the Below Deck style spinoff of She-Hulk when they have just the attorneys pushing paper.
The other thing,
six episodes of reading legal briefs.
Yeah. And you gotta love stop, you know, having be able to watch this with stop motion and go frame by frame by frame. Because now I see in looking at the courtroom scene, there are two photographs on the back wall. And I can see the Wikipedia, which site they pulled, where they pulled the photo from that they put online. And it is the Spring Street Courthouse that has some of the federal courtrooms in it, these two particular buildings.
Yeah, I did some research about courtroom sets down in Southern California. And it's like, yeah, there are a bunch. So they're clearly at one of these where they're filming it. It just as Redwood City, California, the old courthouse that was used in Mrs. Doubtfire. So there's places where they rent them out. So let's get into more of the lawyer response. And Mark Z, you had part of this as well. So there's, well, let's just keep going on. So let's talk CivPro. Jennifer, as a civil litigator, would like your help with how does a motion for summary judgment work?
Well, you have to make a motion. You also need to do some discovery. I was watching this with my dad, who is not a lawyer, and I am a recovering civil litigator, so he doesn't hear me talk this stuff a lot. And the second, the trial or motion hearing, it was a motion hearing, right? And she said, triable fact. I paused it to take a note. And I was like, Dad, I guess this is a summary judgment hearing. And he's like, what? And of course, a couple seconds later, she says it. You know, it's hard to see people take evidence in a hearing because it's just not what happens. And I don't know if any of you have ever written a summary judgment in California. If you know what a separate statement of facts is, like, it's, I mean, to be fair, I'd never want to watch it on TV. It is terribly tedious. But there was just a lot of work that was completely glossed over to get in front of the judge. I mean, it looks like, you know, her lawyer, she looked fabulous, a little bit too fabulous for a summary judgment hearing. That's one other thing that my inappropriate father said while watching that scene. I will not use the exact words, but, you know, just having to get your bearings and see, oh, we're in a summary judgment hearing. How did we get here? And, you know, I have been listening to the podcast. I think every court hearing thus far, everyone that's a lawyer was like, wait, how did we get here? And it would have had to be just a crap ton of discovery, more depositions and interrogatories. And honestly, like the two bites of the apple, you know, you at least know your elements when you go in for a summary judgment. If you don't, you're not going to get your summary judgment, and you're definitely not going to get another chance to come in and prove it.
Yeah. And so for the, since we're using magic lawyer words, a summary judgment is saying there's no dispute of fact. And then as a matter of law, we win. And doing discovery in a case like this, you would need to establish when the marks were put into use. Those would be statement part of the separate statement of fact have said, you know, Mary McPherson said X, and here's the supporting document that was authenticated through deposition testimony. And you jump through all those hoops and you set up saying like, hey, Walters used it first, the law firm was using it, it's her name. If there's helpful information from her cousin Bruce, that could help undercut.
There's definitely a lot of depositions that would have been really helpful here.
Yeah. So it's not something you do in a weekend. And like, I've done them in both. I've worked on them. I haven't been the only one because it's a team sport.
Yeah.
We have a complex insurance case in federal court and done a couple in state court. And you pick a date that's like 75 days in the future. And then that sets when your motion will be due. It then sets when the opposition's due, and then the reply brief, and then when like you're going to get your hearing. And there's going to be a tentative before that where the court says one way or the other. State court guaranteed somebody's going to challenge it. And, you know, the parties will slug it out in front of the judge. And all of that seems to have been, we're doing it tomorrow morning on the fly, magic. And that was my kind of like bite my lip with like, these are hard to do. Like
The tedium of a summary judgment motion, a good one, I mean, that's the way you win them, is you have every fact. And honestly, I talk like I know. I've only been involved in a few. And we won one because when he responded to our summary judgment motion, he didn't address each fact in the separate statement. So it's not, so you can't just go in there and go, oh no, she's wrong, here's some samples. Like, it has nothing to do with what you've got. And in fact, all they had, well, because they didn't even appear to know their elements, right? So, you know, you can't win a case without knowing your elements. She was like, oh, wait, I have to prove that there's personal use, which makes no sense at all, because this is a business use. But I speaking more Civ Pro and beyond my scope there when I get into that.
Yeah, there was some high blood pressure moments in watching this scene, because it's not hard to be right. But I understand they want to show it like in a 25-minute segment as opposed to 4 weeks later. Like they aren't doing that type of show. The Law and Order, you know, saying like where it's now 3 weeks later and we're in court. That's not how they're playing. But again, it's one of those moments of frustration because I love Civ Pro.
Now, well, putting all those dudes in a row on their second hearing is way more fun than separate dude depositions. So,
yeah, even though they're all the witnesses in the courtroom at the same time,
no,
we don't want witness coordination. No. Now, the idea of live evidence being at a MSJ hearing is bizarre. So it's going to be like when we did the Stormtrooper defective body armor mock trial. We did it as an MSJ and we used video depo clips both to help with time and also that way to bring in testimony, because you wouldn't have a witness on the stand. You would need to, but we wanted to have a fun mock trial at a convention. So we're going to use video depos instead. Mark Z, you brought up some of the video evidence issues and that tie to the rules of evidence. Can you help us understand those?
Sure. So for one thing, just what you said, you don't typically have live evidence at a summary judgment hearing. I'm not even sure this would be summary judgment. I would have thought this would have been on an injunction in order to shut this whole thing down. So a preliminary or permanent injunction, even a temporary restraining order, TRO, under Rule 65 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure is really where this probably would have been, but whatever, you know, that's just the way the lawsuit crumbles. Now, because I didn't realize at first this was federal court, when I was taking some notes, I looked up what the California rules. Now, I think it would have been entirely appropriate to show the judge some different videos as evidence. But just what you guys were talking about, my experience in 30 years of civil litigation, there's like no surprises in civil litigation. You know, we may pull a case up at oral arguments where we didn't put that in the brief. That's about probably the most surprising that we ever get from a legal argument standpoint. But from an evidentiary standpoint, you don't have surprises like this, because just what you guys were describing, you know, you did all sorts of, you might have done discovery. You don't always need discovery to get to summary judgment. I have gone to summary judgment and said, you know what? I don't need any discovery. I've got everything right now. I can win right now. Actually, I had this in a Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay case, where the U.S. government arrested one of its own lawyers. And we went without depositions and discovery straight into summary judgment. And I won on it, actually. But under at least California law, and I think the same would be in federal, I don't have a good federal citation in front of me. But as an example, Rule 2.1040 of electronic recordings presented or offered into evidence basically says, if you're going to present a video at the hearing, you're going to have to give the other party the transcript. You're going to have a written transcript. You're going to have to give them the other video. You know, all of this would have been set in motion beforehand. You're not just going to be able to spring it and then require the other party to be able to respond. But obviously that would not be good television for purposes of the She-Hulk trial.
Agreed. And you have to authenticate it. And again, if you're going to have video evidence, you disclose it to the other side. There's again, no surprises with this, which brings us to part of the witness discussion, and there's a lot there with the former dates that are kind of giving, it's not quite character evidence, but they're recounting like why they went on a date. And Io, could you help us understand the witness elements with this?
Yeah, sure. I think when it's, you know, it sort of goes back to what we've been talking about a little bit, the idea that, you know, what's the question at hand, right? Is it that this woman has ever, I mean, you know, I guess the hearing before this genius idea, right, was sort of trying to establish, at least the, you know, for the purpose of this fake world that we're in, the judge has essentially made it clear that evidence that shows that on some, at some point before, you know, other than that one instance on video at, with the TV interview, right, that she wants to establish that she's used this name in any other capacity, because obviously it doesn't make sense for her to bring men that she's, you know, hooked up with as evidence that she's, you know, used that copyright. And what theoretically, what should, not theoretically, actually legally, should be a question of like using it in a business sense. But I think the characters and, you know, sort of part of, you know, what is their testimony proving? And it really is just showing that to, you know, one plus human person, other than on this TV recording, right? Like that she has presented herself as She-Hulk. And, you know, the question, which I just, I mean, of course, there's the drama aspect, which is designed to touch the hearts and souls of viewers, the questions around like, would you have gone on this date with her had she presented herself as Jen Walter? That question seems to be sort of the tipping scale, right? That, you know, but for her, but for the presentation as She-Hulk, this interaction with these people would have never happened. And, you know, she sort of knowing that is why she created the profile and presented herself as She-Hulk, and therefore was accepting the name as opposed to the one, you know, video evidence from Titania's folks. But I think just, I mean, that evidence was, and the questions and the lack of objections.
Yeah. No cross-examination. I mean,
oh yeah, well, we'll never cross on this show. It's just not a thing.
It would have made more sense for Emil Blonsky to have been giving testimony saying, I hired her because she's She-Hulk.
Right.
That at least puts it into commerce. It ties back to the law firm. It's not, who did I speed date with?
And why so many of them? It just doesn't, you know, it should be sort of an et al thing, right? Like, and you know, no evidence of the dates on which they, I thought what was really interesting to me and how this all plays out is there was no conversation about chronology, right? Like, other than Chad's comment, when did she schedule these dates, right? Like, when did she create this account? And, you know, all of this stuff that just does not seem to matter to us in this case. So
this is like taking place all in a week. And like, that's part of the suspension of disbelief. It's like, I'm again fine with throwing the semi truck, like zero problem with that. Having three trials in like 10 days.
I haven't gone on that many dates. Yeah. It's just kind of shrunk together. I guess the idea too is that, you know, they aren't being very clear about how much time is passing. So we could theorize that maybe all this time is passing and she just, you know, maybe that's why she's surprised that she and this guy like recognize each other, because this date was so long ago, and, you know, so long ago that she had enough time to, the Titania's had enough time to you know, get all this, get the registration in and all that, or application.
Yeah, and you know, to bring Jordan as the public defender here, the fact that charges were dropped against Titania seems mind-blowing. Can you just share us your experience if someone broke into a courtroom and tried murdering jurors, or maybe manslaughter because she was angry and starting to throw things? What DA drops that case?
Not one that wants to be employed the next day. Nobody I've ever met who works adjacent to a DA's office would ever drop that case, ever. And I mean, frankly, I don't agree with the DA's on much, but I don't know that I'd blame them for prosecuting that one. You can't interrupt the middle of a like a court proceeding where we're, you know, presumably doing justice in some form or another and expect to just like walk away because you're a famous YouTube celebrity having a tantrum.
Yeah. Well, the diabetes thing, you know, it's this
is had low blood sugar.
Right. Which I guess if you again squint really hard enough, you could see a world where the argument is someone who's, you know, having a mental health crisis. If they were to do something and there was a natural defense, then maybe the DA would drop it in again. You got to squint really hard to see this.
I appreciate the optimism, but I have a humongous caseload of clients with mental health problems who they are still prosecuting.
Got to get you got to get the DAs from She-Hulk and then.
There you go.
There's precedent.
The guy who's just borderline this side of a sexual harassment suit. And
yeah. So with that, it just seems super weird. The other thing that I wanted to mention in California, you could, if they're in federal court on a federal question, you can through ancillary jurisdiction, bring some state court claims. California has Civil Code Section 3344, subsection A, which is use of a person's likeness without their consent. First line, any person who knowingly uses another's name, whole bunch of other stuff, shall be liable for any damages sustained by the person or persons injured as a result thereof. That's part of Jennifer's claim here because it's her name. So that's been publicly used. We're done. Like so again, if it's the a TRO, like it's complete, that's fair game and for that to be in federal court. So with that, jumping ahead to some of the other issues that are coming up, and Mark, you can help with some of the copyright issues here with the Avengers products.
In a trademark,
even with that, what's your reaction?
Well, and trademark examiner is going to just toss those out. There's the alteration of a spelling does not protect a trademark. If it's particularly with the trademark dress they had for the Avengers and the Avengers and all those things, it's all way too close. And I don't know that any trademark examiner would let that stuff go by.
It's changing the vowel does not avoid liability.
No. Well, especially when you're using the same images.
That's what I'm saying. The trade dress around it is identical.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if anyone noticed. So if you, right. So this was the first episode of She-Hulk. And I think maybe the first of any of the Disney Plus series episodes where there wasn't, or even movies, where there wasn't this, you know, end scene after the credits. And there's no, because we watched it like five times going, where the hell is it? Where the hell is it? Thinking we missed it. And then finally went online to look and they're like, nope, there is none. And with no explanation as to why. But that doesn't mean there wasn't some helpful information. If you look, and I'm going to have to pay more attention for the next episodes. If you looked at the drawings that were presented during the end credits, there were two in particular that are relevant to what we're talking about, and maybe some of the other guys can, if you saw anything else. But one was She-Hulk holding a bag of I think Avenger items as marked as evidence, as if she was in some sort of other, you know, copyright or trademark action that she was handling, which maybe she's fulfilling the law firm's hope of being the superhero law division, superhuman law division, and representing the Avengers in an action for infringement. And then there was another scene with Pug and the paralegal whose name I'm blanking on, where they're in his like sneaker closet.
Yeah.
And Nick and you can see a bunch of other, you see the Iron Man 3s, I think it is, right? That he was trying to get with her help, But then you also see some other noticeable characters like Deadpool sneakers, which I guess is the hope that, you know, there's going to be a combination of the universes from the different movie production companies as time goes by.
Yeah, there was a lot of X-Men character designs on those shoes and other things. I thought, and this is a sidetrack, but the Pug character played by Josh Segarra, he played a character in an HBO show called The Other Two. And he was a recurring character, but he became famous in the fashion world for designing novelty footwear. So I thought it was a kind of funny meta over meta fact that he has this shoe collection as his character in this show.
Good attention to detail. I saw Deadpool. I did not see the X-Men shoes. I did not watch the other show. So that is very meta that they totally went there. And Greg, yes.
Yeah, I just about the copyright infringement issue, I struggled with this a little bit, because in my private practice, I do a lot of entertainment law. So in one of the things I'll just state, I'm not a litigator. I have litigated, but that's well behind me now. But in terms of when you're suing for someone for copyright infringement, the first thing you got to ask is who is the plaintiff or plaintiffs, and therefore who are the copyright owners here? So here we're looking at these designs here. I know in the real world, in, you know, Disney, they own all the, you know, all the likenesses to the characters and et cetera, but in the MCU. Okay. So is the copyright owner the Avengers? Right. So, and then the next question after that is, what is the legal status of the MCU Avengers? And something I pulled from the MCU wiki was that the Avengers were a team of extraordinary individuals, et cetera, though primarily affiliated with the interest of the United States of America. The group's purpose was to protect, et cetera, et cetera. So that doesn't give me a whole lot in terms of, okay, what's their legal status? Is it just a group of individuals? Are they a partnership? Are they an LLC? Or are they a corporation? Is there an Avengers Corp somewhere registered in some state? So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is that were the Avengers disbanded? And if so, who were their successors or the assignees of the Avengers-owned copyrighted designs? Stark Industries? Who knows, right? So, and then going to the next issue going beyond there is like, so what are the actual works as a term in copyright law being copied here in an unlicensed illegal manner? Did the Avengers commission? Let's for the sake of argument, let's say the Avengers are some kind of body corporate or something like that. Did they commission the designs? We kind of don't know that right now, because what we've seen, at least what I remember seeing in their very first Avengers movie after the Battle of New York, then you had all these people with their Avengers gear, like merch on, and I think people were selling it, if I'm remembering correctly. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But aren't those more like just random people? They're kind of like akin to fan art. They're just worshiping these superheroes and they're making their own designs like that. So if these are knockoffs of some of those, and there is an original designer who has designed those shirts, and now there's this knockoff, then the plaintiff and the proper copyright owner have to trace it all the way back to who authored, the artist, those designs, and then then follow the chain of title. Who is now the current owner of the design? Was it transferred to someone else? And then was it transferred again? And then who was it? So it's one of those things that we don't have full information on, but that's where I see as one key challenge here, based on what has been presented to us on screen, as to who would be in the position to assert their right as a copyright owner in a hypothetical lawsuit for copyright infringement.
I think we would look towards team sports as part of the answer, because the Avengers logo, they adopt kind of like a letter A in a specific design, mm-hmm. that's on Captain America's uniform in Age of Ultron. So I would look at the art that forms the word Avengers as being something that theoretically Stark would have copyrighted. Again, thinking back to Age of Ultron, Stark refers to Cap as being in charge and he pays for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Probably Stark Industries had lawyers who did base work to try to protect Stark's bank accounts from being sued left and right, to form some kind of nonprofit that could have at least owned the
nonprofit.
I suppose, but well, someone did the signage on the Avengers Tower. I mean, that was had to be, that artwork was part of their logo. Exactly. So I think Stark is probably the person to look at. He's got probably the team of lawyers that would make sure he's protected.
Even in the first Avengers movie, you see that A with the circle logo come in from Stark Tower during the Battle of New York. The other letters fall off, and the only ones left on Stark Tower is the A, which is where they get that. So presumably Stark owns that some way, shape, or form.
And in one of the earlier She-Hulk episodes, they blend together now in my mind, where she asked such a great question, or I think it was the paralegal who did, I can't remember, right? Is there insurance, right? If you're part of the team, do they, and there's health insurance, right? If you get injured, is there health insurance? But also, is there insurance for the collateral damage that you cause that, led to the Sokovia Accords and the like? And, some of the questions, the very good questions that Greg is raising brought to my mind, a whole bunch of other issues about, what's the real relationship depending on in time the Avengers to the U.S. government? Are they acting as contractors to the U.S. government? Are they acting or under the control? Certainly we see sometimes where the government believes the Avengers are acting responsive to them, or in Civil War when the Avengers are breaking apart and taking sides in the Sokovia Accords, where some of the Avengers clearly are acting as agents of the U.S. government for purposes of arrest, that also raises lots of questions, because at least in the United States, Greg, I don't know, in Canada, the U.S. cannot copyright and trademark anything. I don't know if there's any exceptions, maybe that Mark with a C knows that versus me. But, that's why we see lots of documents like the 9/11 Commission report or the torture reports, or the Warren Commission report from the JFK assassination, where multiple publishers publish them in different versions with an editorial at the front or the back, because the U.S. government has no ownership right in those public documents. And then it got me thinking about when the She-Hulk and her friend go to get the clothing, who also is a character that is in the Marvel Universe, although I didn't recognize the person, but where they claim that she is an Avenger. So I have a case right now, actually, where one of my federal clients was arrested for impersonating a police officer. That was the allegation. Charges were dropped, thankfully. But by them saying she's part of the Avengers when she's not, were they committing a crime, or was the She-Hulk? It's unclear whether she pretended still to be, because she is told that that's what they said to the guy. So there could be a crime that she was committing for purposes of that, or maybe the Avengers want to sue her for impersonation or false light, saying that she's part of them and they don't want her in the Avengers. So there are a whole bunch of other legal issues that came up that I didn't even think about until Greg mentioned it.
So with that, Mark, I know Mark Hirschhorn has to jump off. Where can people find Succotash, and yes, any social media that you want to share?
Sure. It's succotashshow.com. And the social media is all at Succotash Show on both Twitter and on Instagram. And the show features clips from comedy podcasts, much like Legal Geeks, who's been featured before. And I'm sure going to feature this particular episode very soon. So thanks for letting me play, guys. It's been great.
Good seeing you. We'll need to catch up again.
Nice meeting you, Mark.
Absolutely. Likewise.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, everybody. So let's do a little lightning round of any legal issues anyone spotted that they want to address. And in the tradition of the McLaren of Saturday Night Live with Pat Buchanan Wrong, Jennifer, any legal issues that you want to point out or comments about this episode?
Well, I thought this was actually a pretty good episode, despite the terrible lawyering. Summary judgments aren't fun to watch, but they did bring up some issues that I thought were pretty fun. I kept thinking about this case I had read about a wedding dress designer named Haley Page. I was on, so there's another woman, but I actually went wedding dress shopping with a friend, to another friend's high school friend, Haley Page. And it turned, she ended up being in a big IP lawsuit because when she was 25 years old, she sold her soul to a wedding dress manufacturer. At some point, she started to use her Instagram, which was Miss Haley Page, to do things instead of just selling wedding dresses. She had gotten into some influencing and some other things. And what they ended up suing her on was saying that the Instagram handle belonged to them. At the end of the day, she gets fired, and to this day, she cannot use her own Instagram, and she can't sell wedding dresses under her name. Now, she, unlike She-Hulk and Titania, there was a contractual relationship, but it did get down into the personal use versus the professional use of your name. And, you know, I think when She-Hulk first got served papers, and she's like, what? I didn't even want this name. And in the case of Haley Page, she did want a career as, you know, a wedding dress designer. But I don't think, you know, at the age of 25, signing a contract without a lawyer, she understood that they would own her name. And so if you go to her Instagram page today, it is solely pictures of wedding dresses that the wedding dress designer has put up there with models. It's not the person Haley Page talking anymore. So, you know, there are situations where this can happen, where you can lose your name. She-Hulk is not her name. It's a given name. But I thought it was kind of a fun way to play with, you know, IP law in a way to make IP lawyers crazy, but to make it good for entertainment. I also wanted to say that there is a lip plumper that's called Venom. She joked about the actual snake oil sales, and I just thought that was too cute. I haven't owned that since, I think, 2002. If I had, I would have worn it for you guys.
Thank you. Jordan, any lightning round comments?
Like Jennifer, actually, I really enjoyed this episode. I think if you take all of the kind of courtroom scenes and the A story out, this was their strongest episode. I loved Nikki and Pug going around trying to find fashion for She-Hulk. I don't know that there are any other legal issues in this episode that we haven't covered, but I also really thought the idea of client confidentiality for the clothing designer was particularly amusing. It's another one of those where they use legal terms of art as just kind of a set dressing for things. But it was really kind of amusing that this guy, you know, might have a client confidentiality agreement like Jennifer.
An NDA.
And,
yeah.
Well, and wasn't that Daredevil? So it was another lawyer.
Oh, it was absolutely Daredevil.
that was for us.
Yeah. That is aside, I'm also kind of excited about Daredevil coming back.
Yes, thrilled. But it's like good catch on the NDA issue, because there's no Taylor confidentiality privilege. So no. So Io, any lightning round thoughts?
The one thing that I enjoyed this episode, but I enjoy all of the episodes, that the thing that frustrated me the most was, why is Titania suing She-Hulk? I understand the plot device part of it, but why? Like, why would you, you know, just because the end result, you know, at the end of the episode, Titania now has got millions of products to do God knows what with, but she started, it's sort of like she started a fight that cost her everything, and she, you know, did. And so my frustration is maybe more of the story telling, where I thought, okay, she's She-Hulk. If someone's selling things, the way that I would have flipped it is the boss comes and says, you know, you got to get this handle. This is ridiculous. and go from there. But I think they wanted a service of process scene and to kind of do all of that. But I just thought, if I'm, you know, first in line trademark, you know, trolling someone and doing all of that, like, why would I sue them other than, you know, Titania is supposed to be a terrible person who hates Jen and wants to ruin her life. But anyway, that frustrated me sort of from a, you have a lawyer, why is your lawyer letting you or allow, you know, taking money from you to file this lawsuit that ends up ruining you, sort of.
Yeah, because suing She-Hulk out of vindictiveness doesn't make sense, because without She-Hulk, Titania would have been going away on murder charges. And so it's like, it's the wrong fight. It's going up to the bully and trying to hit him and then surprised when he breaks your nose. So it's a bad fight.
She could have made like a lot of money before She-Hulk would have sued her. And it just seemed like, you know,
I feel like there was a licensing agreement that got missed there.
Yeah. Greg, first, please come back. You're invaluable and we want you here. Secondly, any other lightning round comments that you would like to add?
So the first thing that I want to just mention is that, and Josh, you alluded to it about the statutory right of publicity in California. And I had a look at it. I don't have a whole lot of experience with the rights of publicity other than in my work as an entertainment lawyer to make sure that we get all clearances for, you know, people that appear in the film, right? So I thought that was really interesting. And looking at the courtroom scene again, where they are, Jen's lawyer is making the argument, they're presenting evidence, I thought, well, they actually, that works really, really well to establish that, you know, her right to publicity. Her name doesn't need to be famous. She just has to establish that that's her name and someone else is, you know, illegally profiting off of that name. So I thought that worked really well. You know, like it might have not been framed that way, but, you know, the evidence presented, the arguments put forth worked really well. So I really appreciated that. And another thing that I thought that could be dealt with those bootlegged Avengers goods is that there's a, I know we have it in our copyright and trademarks acts, and I looked it up in the States. It's, I think, 18 U.S. Code 2320, trafficking in counterfeit goods or services. So with that, then, you know, there could be some enforcement body could possibly shut them down, right? So there's that. And then just a comment about the copyright issue and the owner of the copyright. If in fact it is Stark Industries that owns the Avengers design, the mark, and all sorts of stuff, then who is running Stark Industries right now? And I think in What If we saw it's Pepper Potts, right? So it'd be Pepper Potts who would be instructing counsel to go after these guys if they want to bring that suit. And one last thing, Titania, a trademark, I think, I forget which Mark brought it up, is that Titania should apply to register her own name as a trademark, since she could just rebrand everything as Titania instead. In real life, there is an actual Titania. There's one Titania registered mark on the USPTO, and that is by Bell's Brewery in Michigan for stickers, bumper stickers, coasters, cardboard coasters, printed coasters, handbags, purses, umbrellas, messenger bags, patio umbrellas, beverage glassware, bottle openers, insulated sleep, etc., 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 towels. Oh, and of most interest, ale, beer, porter, stout, malt liquor.
So Titania. If they do custom, we should order some Legal Geek swag from them just for. For a meta purpose. So that's,
there you go.
Great research, man. So Mark, bring us home, buddy. Thoughts?
So I got 3.5 because I had 3 and then Greg just brought up one to me to comment on when he talked about the Title 18 enforcement code. And anyone who's been to as many Comic-Cons across the country as I have been, and I'm sure a bunch of you guys have been, have undoubtedly seen the police come into the Comic-Con and shut down someone's booth who is selling what turns out to be very obviously bootleg DVDs. I've seen it too many times at some of the bigger conventions. So there is absolutely the enforcement police of DVDs and copyright infringement, trademark infringement. I think they tend to be, I think they're just even local cops. I remember once in Philly that happened. Anyway, there were 3 points that I saw that relate to things we have talked about before, but just didn't talk about in this episode. For one, the beginning of the summary judgment, which should have been injunction, lawsuit, where her lawyer, Titania's lawyer, starts it off with saying, this is an entirely frivolous suit and should just be dismissed. I have said that, yes, in cases, I'm sure. And I have also learned over the decades that that just doesn't work. And unless you really, really 195% believe the other side is frivolous, don't even waste your time saying frivolous in any motion. It's just not going to work. And it just takes extra word count, especially in some jurisdictions where you have a word count limitation. Then at the end of the, towards the end of the episode, when Jennifer and her lawyer are meeting for drinks, which is Ms. Book, there was one statement that was made that caught my attention, where she said, don't know any other lawyer who would humiliate themselves like that to win a case, referring to bringing in the dates, who obviously said they preferred to be with She-Hulk rather than Jennifer. And actually, which reminded me of another thing I meant to say, I don't think it was innocent or inadvertent that when Jennifer in herself, her true self, went up to Titania at the sales exhibit, that Titania knew exactly who she was and said, Jennifer Walters, I own your name, or something, whatever the heck she said. But she knew exactly who Jennifer was, which I'm not sure, at least from what we saw in the episodes, she wouldn't have. Now, she was Jennifer when she broke through the courtroom from traffic court, which in my jurisdiction in DC, traffic court is at the DMV. It is not in any of the other courthouses. I don't know where it is for you guys. But then, you know, when she got pounded on, it was by She-Hulk. So she didn't necessarily know it was Jennifer. And then the final point, which we have said in other episodes and is clearly a continuing actor, actress thing that they like to do, God damn it, tell your client to sit down and shut up and stop arguing arguments and trying to introduce evidence or making comments to the judge. You are fired. You know, we'll go back to Donald Trump. You are fired if you do that in any of my cases as my client. And actually, I have yelled at clients who stupidly would not shut up in depositions afterwards. So that is clearly a vehicle that they continue to use and will undoubtedly use again. But as a lawyer, it drives me crazy.
Agreed. It just, the client shouldn't keep quiet. This is why you have a lawyer. So that way they represent you. They're speaking for you. They're going to make sure you're heard. Shut up. So like it's a, you're making it harder to help you. So,
and at least her lawyer did say at one point, just sit down. Just sit down, please.
Not helping.
But at least they seem to have learned that when you're addressing the court and the judge, you stand up.
They did improve there.
She did it. Every time her Titania's lawyer stood up, she stood up too. And then he's like, no, sit, just sit, just sit.
Maybe you shouldn't have your client at counsel's table. Maybe that might help that part.
Yeah, the number of times I've been in court in a civil case with the client is rare.
Like, we would do it. Now, I was in federal court just the other day, and with my client, sat, the client will sit with you at the table. My client did not say anything. that was a good thing. But they were with me at counsel's table in federal court.
Yeah, again, it would depend. Like, we had an ex party a couple weeks ago that we had to show up for. The client did not attend with me for the ex party hearing to appoint a discovery referee. It's like, no, we will report. So yeah, there's, oh boy. Anyway, there's a lot here. There's a lot here. With that said, I want to thank everyone and Greg, and thank you for offering your expertise, and please come back. Jennifer, this was the first night you were able to join us because of scheduling. Thank you for being here, and definitely want your insight. So please help us with episode 6 next week. As for Mark, Jordan, and Io, pleasure as always. Glad you guys are here, and thank you for all the notes. So for everyone, in the words of Mark Hirschhorn, past Succotash, go check them out. And we will be back. And until then, wherever you listen to us, please leave a review and stay safe, stay healthy, and stay geeky. Take care.